You are listening to another Screenfish One-on-One live from TIFF 2018. In this one-on-one, we get to talk with writer Roddy Doyle and director Patty Bernach, the creative team behind Rosie, one of my favorite films at the festival this year. Rosie tells the story of a young family that are looking for a place to stay after they are kicked out by their landlord. We get to talk to Roddy and Patty about where the idea for the film came, their use of realism and joy in the midst of struggle. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Thank you both so much for the chance to chat. I mean, I know you've been here for a long time today, and your day is adding up, but I really appreciate the chance to chat with you about what is genuinely, I think, a great film.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Maybe you can tell us, Roddy, a little bit how you came up with the idea of the film and what research did you do?
Well, just short of 2 years ago, I was in my kitchen making coffee, I think, and I was half listening to the radio news, and there was a woman on the radio describing her day the day before and her attempts to find somewhere to live with her in a car with her children. And she was very good, very precise. And what really gave me pause for thought was when she said that her partner couldn't help her because he was at work. And I was thinking, here's a functioning, happy family who just don't have a roof over their heads. And there's a... It almost goes beyond... It almost... seems absurd, you know. So I thought, I stopped. Well, I listened to the interview, it wasn't very long, but I just thought, well, there's a story there, you know. I can tell a story. 24 hours roughly, that's what my idea was at first, you know, 24 hours in their day, in her day particularly, trying to find somewhere to stay. So I immediately started planning it, you know. So I went up to my office and started work. I can't remember what I was working on, but I shoved it aside for 4 days, I think, and worked on a treatment for what became Rosie. Gave her a name really almost immediately. It was a new bridge across the Liffey called the Rosie Hackett Bridge.
Wow.
Best named bridge in Dublin, you know, it's a great bridge. And so I gave it a name, Rosie. I think it's a lovely name, you know, a brilliant name. So that's a big part, you know, when you can give somebody a name immediately. And so that's where the initial work went in. I did precious little research. I didn't feel the need to. I didn't go looking for the woman who had been given the interview. I didn't want it to be a documentary in any way, and I didn't want to be a slave to other people's facts. But I just fell back on, you know, it's like a lot of, you know, when you read about homeless people, sometimes a moment in their lives knocks them sideways in a way that they can never quite recover from. And some of them, it's much, much darker. Like in some of the stories of women who are homeless, stepfathers seem to be a significant factor.
Yeah.
Others, it's grief. The death of a wife, the death of a child. You know, I can imagine the death of a child destroy you. You know, destroy you, be incapable of working, I would imagine. But in this case, what made this really more interesting was the fact that this mundane almost thing, you know, that this mundane, otherwise boring, you know, husband, wife, four children life that goes on has been completely and utterly knocked sideways. So I kind of fell back on my memories of bringing my own kids to school and juggling, you know, you juggle all the time when you've got children, you know, trying to keep an eye on all of them while you're doing the shopping and trying to fill the car and, you know, trying to, you know, in the case of a little child, trying to make sure that their teddy bear or whatever is still there, and they insist on bringing the bloody thing everywhere, you know, and the certain knowledge is going to be robbed and you're hoping it won't be, you know. So I just made that more extreme. And later on, when Paddy was on board, we wandered around a part of Dublin and met the people who work for one of the homeless agencies, and they added a certain phrases into the later drafts, you know, a little bit more precision than I had. But that was about the third draft, I think, Paddy. So little details were added as we went along. The research, there wasn't... You know, in terms of the fundamentals of the story, there wasn't much research, really. There wasn't any need for it.
But there was a sort of process a bit went happened later on,
yeah.
In a sense, just to kind of check the veracity of it, you know, and make sure the detailing of that was right, and what would happen in this situation. We went into it, but it was sort of almost afterwards, in a sense. But the research is in it, in a way, because the fact is that they're not homeless people; they're people who are homeless. So they were a family before they were homeless.
Yeah,
so
the
research is about what it's like to be a family,
yeah.
And what are the jeopardies, what are the things in that that come under threat.
Yeah.
So they're things that you know very well.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
That's the amazing thing about this particular film. You guys, of course, you don't know me at all, but. You know, I work with youth, and we actually have done a lot of work with the homeless. We just came from volunteering for a week in a homeless shelter in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that struck me is that the film just felt real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of films, when they deal with the homeless, they sort of take a sensational approach, but there's sort of a naturalism to the film. Mm-hmm.
Or they only take that dimension of the people, you know, that they take the dimension of them, which is homeless, let's say, as opposed to that these are people who have lives, who have levity in their lives, who have long-standing habits and ways of behaving with each other, who've kind of needs and from what's going on in their school, what's all of those other aspects of their lives. And I think that was what was great about the script, that that's where you were starting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For me, if you just make it about, you know, homeless people, it becomes very rigid and two-dimensional quite quickly. Whereas if it's people who are homeless, it's about, the emphasis is on that life. And about trying to sustain that and sustain that normality, or the tensions and pressures that are beginning to show on their normality as it comes under pressure. So just trying to preserve that and the lightness that people have, even in situations where, you know, there is a headline issue going on. Other issues come in, like a kid needs to go to the toilet, or a child's need to have a bit of a laugh, to break something, and like in that chip fight where something has to give at some stage, where other factors, the truth of life comes through, you know, and in a way that makes it more poignant, because it's, you see, the desire and need for children to have fun and messing and a bit of rebellion is still there, but it's getting harder, you know. That's the thing.
Yeah, that was something I thought was so beautiful. I don't think a food fight has ever looked so beautiful in a film.
I think it's a lovely
moment of joy, and the touches of, you know, I need to go to the toilet. I never thought that would be a recurring theme in a film before, but again, it just brings
it's part of the reality.
Absolutely. It's just the reality of the moment.
The food fight was like, you know, I knew instinctively what I wanted to do with it. I think it was brilliant that Roddy had written that, because I think it's a scene that hasn't been done before. It was something that was fresh. It was a very immediate way to show a kind of some fundamental desire to kick against something, to rebel against something that's going on, some instinctive way of doing that, and for them all, and to find a moment's joy together and bonding together in that crazy, ridiculous thing. But there was a sort of, I know a lot of people didn't understand how that was going to happen, or what was going to happen, or why would they throw food at each other, and you know, there was a sort of, won't it be a bit disgusting or something? There was a kind of all sorts of things around the edges that, and it was, you know, I felt it was in it, and luckily it came out, and particularly Dara, the little boy, he really drove that scene, and I gave him a responsibility to drive it, and he knew I'd given him this. I took him aside and brought him up this to one point. I laid it on him in a sense and said, you have to make this happen. You have to go for this and really enjoy it and push and make everybody shock them all with it, and don't be kind of half spitting out the chip. You've got to go for it, you know. And he relished it and did it, and I think he made the scene, actually, you know.
Did you have to prepare the kids? I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. Did you have to prepare the kids? Because this is a mature theme, but they're also sort of shielded from it. Did they understand what was happening?
I prepared them to the extent that, you know, let's say in the sense it created a sort of atmosphere of to try and create a relaxed and atmosphere they felt comfortable with each other and with me and crew and Mo and Sarah. And then I asked the parents not to never to prepare with them the night before, you know, maybe just go through their lines the night before so they knew their lines or had a fair idea of the lines that they had, but not to rehearse it in the sense where they had a version of it in their heads that was going to get set. And I think I said if you want to read the script, if you feel it's right to read the script, and that's okay, but I didn't feel it was completely necessary. So it was a sort of more general sense of what was going on for these people, but it became much more about what are we doing today, what's this moment, and going from moment to moment and making it situational, I suppose, you know, that it's you are in this situation now and this is what's happening, and that's how we worked it, you know.
You know, you talked before about kicking against something. Roddy, there's a line in the film that I love, and it's, we're not homeless, we're just lost. I was in love with that line. I just love it. It's just so poignant. But can you talk a little bit about that? Because you see that Rosie and John Paul are doing that. They are kicking against this notion. He goes to visit the house. He doesn't like the insinuation. He leaves. You see Rosie in this constant verbal conflict. No, that's not who we are.
Yeah.
Well, I can't imagine anybody being comfortable with the notion of being called homeless. It must be a terrible blanket to let lie on yourself, the fact that you're homeless, you know. And if she says, if she conceded, because it's John Paul's brother who says, uses the phrase homeless, no room for the homeless. If she concedes they're homeless, I would imagine she'll be making less phone calls somehow. You know, so it's the notion of being homeless. And for him, from his point of view, I mean, when he breaks down a bit towards the end, because he's saying, you know, he apologizes and she says, you've got nothing to be saying sorry for. And he says, but it's my job, it's to look after you. So it's a huge word, homeless. Home, you know, is probably the most emotional word I can think of. In my own experience, I have a really strong sense of home. I always had as a railway bridge about 4 miles from where I grew up, and if you're coming from the city centre, I always felt when we went under that railway bridge and the bay opened up in front of us, that I always felt that this is my home. And I still live within that, you know, I live within walking distance of that bridge now. So the word home, both the house and the general area, has always had a huge meaning for me, you know. And then you add less to that, you know. It was, again, coming up with the word lost took a while. But again, yeah, and she says that we've lost the keys. And that's what it feels like. And that's, you know, again, when you lose your keys, you ought not wear the keys. But there's a good nugget of hope there that they're in another pair of trousers, or you left them on the kitchen table, or they're not gone, you know. The consequence is not that you'll never get into your house again. It's an inconvenience, you know, and it can be, you know, it can knock you sideways, but to be homeless is such a dreadful thing. So she's not willing to, the same when she's asked, they're going to give her this rough sleepers number. We're not rough sleepers, we're not rough anything. This is coming on top of Smelly Nelly, Smelly Me. You know, all these little things nibbling away at her.
And how language is important in all those things, you know, with the words. And it's funny, just when you say, my father told me that he remembers that when he was very young as a kid, there was a woman who lived across the road from them, and she was distraught in the front of her house, and she was obviously having a breakdown or was gone mad or whatever. And he said to his mother, Mammy, what's wrong with her? And he was probably only 4 or 5, you know, what's happening? And she said, she's lost her keys. Was the way of she explained it, you know. And that my father now always says, as long as you have your keys, you're all right, you know. That's a kind of reference for control order, you know, in the word. But I think that the thing, and the lost word is interesting, because again it comes back to, you know, home is your orientation, It's the space from which you can approach the world in the way that the child's transitional object is an interface between them and the world.
Yeah.
A home is our interface, which lets us organize ourselves to confront or engage with the world. And if you don't have that orientation, where's your certainty? Where are you from? Where can you base the small mini decisions mm-hmm. of your life
yeah.
That build up, that let you build a fabric beyond that, you know, and a structure in your life beyond that? So I think it's that idea that you're lost without it, you know, mm-hmm. that you don't have a place.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a place, where are you?
Yeah. Well, you know, springboarding off that, most of this film takes place in a car.
Yeah.
That must have been challenging to shoot, but because that car literally becomes the home in many ways.
Yeah.
And
it's
the script, it was a much smaller car.
I had to take a bit of license there.
It was a smaller car than that? This was hardly a limo, as
yeah.
No, it was a much smaller car.
All
my wish was that, you know, we get a relatively tall director so that we make life as miserable as possible.
Have to hunch over.
Succeeded as well. Every day was a humiliation.
Yeah. It was, you know, it was, there was... I kind of early on made the decision that I wanted to be in the car and not looking in at them, but being in with them. And there's a few shots at the very beginning, or one shot and a few shots at the end, where we look in and otherwise we're in with them all the time. And that's, you know, that there's actually a kind of numbers game, a physical numbers game. How wide is a camera? How long is a camera? What, you know, with X lens on, what type of shot you got. So I went and did a lot of tests on that to see which was the best car for us to get, you know, from that point of view. And also figuring out, you know, it's hard enough to figure out, is there a car that can take three child seats in the back? And then to figure out that can take a director, a sound man, and a cameraman, and a focus puller in there somehow as well. So there was like some, like, you know,
you're ripping out the back seat at that point.
We were hiding.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So we were hiding there, but it gives an immediacy and a visceral sort of thing that you're there. You feel that you're present with them, and particularly when you know there's a couple of longer takes earlier on in the film. You know, where she gets out and we track around with her and she comes to the side door and then goes back in. And it just sells that sort of feeling that you were there with her at that time, you know, that you were in some sort of extra presence within the car witnessing this.
Yeah, there's a consistency with Rosie and John Paul and the kids at all times.
Yeah.
So many long takes and close-ups, and Rosie's moving, the camera's moving, you're right with her and all that stuff. And that even the fact that you guys are doing it over, I think it's at 36 hours, you know, just this compressed moment in life, I thought was so, so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you both this. We start to wrap this up. What is it that you hope people take away from Rosie?
Well, I hope to come away. Personally, I hope to come away thinking, oh, that was a very good film.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Really. And maybe a sense that could be me.
Mm.
You know, check doesn't go into the bank account.
Yeah.
You know, I know somebody who, they had health insurance and a major heart attack. And, then realised that actually they didn't have health insurance. It was some sort of a blip. Payments hadn't been made and the insurance had been stopped.
Wow.
And the notification of that went to the wrong address. You know, so suddenly, it's a big enough problem anyway, it knocks you really sideways and you're more acquainted with mortality than you'd like to. And suddenly not only that, but the safety belt you thought you had isn't there either.
Mm.
So these things, the little things that knock us sideways happen all the time, and I'd like to think that people maybe watching the film would look at it that way and think, that could be me.
Mm.
Or that could be, in the case of me now at my age, that could be one of my children.
Yeah.
Mm. Very likely, very possible, given rents and things like that. Mm. You know, that could be one of my children. You know, so, you know, if it sparks off, I hate the phrase, I used to it's one of those phrases that has become kind of the word conversation. Like, it's often just abuse online. Abuse is being described as the conversation. But if it did spark a bit of a conversation, I think it'd be terrific. But ultimately, what I want is people to just come away thinking, well, that was a very good film.
Mm. Yeah. I'm not a campaigner, and I'm not a campaigner because I wouldn't be a good campaigner.
Right.
It's not my gift or whatever. And so again, like Roddy, I want to make a story that has an impact on people, and that impact is that it's felt. What they do with those feelings afterwards, I would hope, you know, that if it's meaningful enough to people, that it makes people have a conversation, maybe take action, do something with it. But for me, my job is about making them feel something and giving an insight into something that I suppose enriches our understanding of that even with people who are resilient, if you keep putting pressure on them, something gives. And I think we live in a time where I think there's a lot of pressures. You know, maybe we went through a very good period and it's beginning to roll back a bit, and there's a lot of pressure coming on people. They don't have a lot of time to manage those pressures.
Yeah.
It's a period where I think we're getting closer to our margins, let's say.
Well, I mean this genuinely, not just because I have a chance to sit in front of you. It's a great film.
Thank you very much.
And the things you're saying about it being about the family, absolutely true. It comes across, and just thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the chance to speak. It's great. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Real pleasure.
Thanks a million. Take care.